Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 93, where we present our professional development workshop on classics of organization and management theory, regarding key approaches to the study of work. This workshop was held at the 2022 annual meeting of the Academy of Management in Seattle, Washington, in the United States. This is part one of the episode where we present two talks. The first is by Steve Barley on the work of the Chicago School tradition of study on work and occupations, and the second by Gina Dacco on the traditions of research into employment and careers. To learn more about the workshop, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now turn it over to Pedro, who is the facilitator for the workshop.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah? Good. Welcome. Welcome to our session, Classics of Organization and Management Theory, this year focusing on approaches to the study of work. I'm Pedro Monteiro. I'm an assistant professor at Copenhagen Business School. I'm very glad to say that Sam Ortiz and Jerry Diamond just here from the Talking About Organizations podcast, of which I'm a member as well, have stepped up and have helped me organize the session. So the program for today is the following. We're going to start with a quick introduction from me about the history of this PDW. Then we're going to have the presentations from the different four speakers. Then we're going to have a panel discussion among them. And then we're going to have the roundtables. Depending on the timing, if you have enough time, we may give the people the opportunity to do switch around in the roundtables, or if not, we just do one. Let's see how we progress and decide then. So in terms of introduction, I think the first question we have to answer is why a PDW on classics, right? And we are not the first to insist on the importance of looking back in order to step forward. But I think there are at least two reasons why it's important to continue to dialogue with the classics, not just treat them as objects in a museum. I think first, there is something about intellectual respect. It's a some form of professional standard that we should recognize those that came before us, and understand that what we are doing today dialogue and has a bearing to the previous works that was done by others, and recognize and respect that. And also, I think that our scholarship is more robust and perhaps more coherent by doing that, meaning that by engaging with the classics, we are able to have more points of comparisons. We are able to enlarge our capacity to analyze and use methods and think that maybe what we are going through today, has some echoes to what's happened in the past and try to understand and dialogue with that. So that is one of the reasons that we created, we are part of this effort to try to bring the classics, which actually did not start here with the PDW, but it started with a podcast that I created with colleagues 7 years ago called the Talking About Organization podcast. And our mission is exactly to try to disseminate ideas from classic scholarship. We have, ever since we created that, produced 9-to-1 episodes, right? They're all available both on the website, on iTunes, Spotify, and all those platforms. And we were happy to say that we have quite a wide audience of around 20,000 listeners per every episode, right? So there is people that is interested to all that. We are happy to see that. And I think that this is great and we were happy to do that. But at some point in doing the podcast, we realized that we were always just talking among ourselves in this small group of junior scholars that produce it, but never get to have a dialogue with people out there in the world directly. And also, we thought it would be interesting to try to bring this conversation to AOM. Of course, being an academic conference, we want to know what is the cutting edge and what is new. But we felt that it would be an opportunity to put that in a broader context and in perspective and encourage people to have a more meaningful dialogue with previous scholarship instead of just pursuing and focusing on new concepts or new theme. So that is how DeepSpeedW started. It started in 2018. So this is actually the fourth iteration we do that. We have played with the format a little bit in different years, but it's basically the same idea. We try to bring distinguished speakers to think about and reflect about a particular author or tradition or school of thought. Despite these different formats, I think there are two principles we try to abide to as we put together the DeepSpeedW every year. One is that we try to select themes and authors that both represent of what would be considered the canon, but also to a little bit enlarge in that canon and bring spaces to voices and traditions that may not be heard normally in particular conversations. And another thing that is very important for us is to always try to construct panels that have gender balance. So across all these years, that's something that we have lived by and continue to do. So this year, we wanted to do a thing a little bit different and trying to more explicitly connect a current conversation to a previous conversation. And as we know, the so-called work or the future of is a big theme, is a big keyword, right? Both in OMT, but also beyond in business practices. It has become of a catchword. I just have a quick n-gram here showing how there's a spike in this expression, which to some extent is great to see such interest. But sometimes when I read some of that stuff that go under this banner, I'm a little bit concerned because maybe it's just me, but I have the impression that people seem to have restarted their conversation 2-3 years ago, not recognize that this has been going for a while. So the effort today is exactly to do that, you know, to bring the conversation that has existed for a long time about work to that so-called interest that exists. I just want to flag a little plug that we are very interested and concerned on the topic of work in our podcast. We have produced all sorts of different episodes about, you know, from Taylor to Rosemary Stewart and dealing with topics like job design, but also work and emotion. So that is just a quick selection of some of the episodes that we have that are more or less in this area. But that is basically what I had in terms of introduction. We are going to go on to the presentations, which are ordered in alphabetical order by surname. So we're going to start with Steve Barley from UC Santa Barbara, who will be telling us about the Chicago School. Then we're going to have Gina Docco, who's going to talk about employment and careers. Then we're going to have Ingrid Erickson from Syracuse University that will tell us about the computer-supported cooperative work tradition. And then, last but not least, David Nicolini from Warwick University telling us about the Tavistock Institute. So we're going to start with Steve. Thank you.
All right. So to start off, I want to make sure we're all clear that I am not talking about the Chicago School of Economics today. I really don't care. I don't care about nor care for Milton Friedman or Gary Becker or George Stigler or the whole other group of people that, in my opinion, led us down the path of destruction with neoliberalism. But aside from that, what I will be talking about is the Chicago School of Sociology, or more accurately, the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago, which was founded in 1892 by Albion Small, who had been the president of Colby College in Maine. It was brought to Chicago to establish what became the first Department of Sociology in the United States. Now, some people say, some historians say, that there were two Chicago schools of sociology. Other historians say there's only one. I side with those who say there were two, since it was the research that was associated with the second that influenced me. And so if I only say one, I have nothing really to talk about. But I would like to say a few words about the first Chicago school, which spans the period roughly from 1900 to the mid-1930s. The core faculty at this period of time were W.I. Thomas, Robert Ezra Park, Ellsworth Ferris, and Ernest Burgess, and probably most of you have never heard of these guys. None of them had degrees in sociology, as you might expect, because this was the first department of sociology in the United States. They came from backgrounds like journalism. There was a high proportion of people who had been ministers' children, and that kind of makes sense because these guys took the city of Chicago as their laboratory and investigated and invented fields that we would now call urbanization, immigration, the study of ethnic groups, the study of crime, and the study of deviance. There were among this group almost no studies of work, occupations, or organizations at this point in time. The primary methods that these folks used were field work, interviews, and life histories, and these would remain primary methods at the University of Chicago into the late 50s and early 1960s when computers took over. Unlike European sociology at the time, these guys were decidedly empirical, and along with Florian Zanecki, I don't think I probably said that right, but who knows, he was a Polish sociologist. He got together with W.I. Thomas to write a book called The Polish Peasant in Europe and America. This was published as five volumes between 1918 and 1920. And why would you want to know about this? You might want to know about this for one reason and one reason only, and that is this was the first empirical sociological treatise published. Prior to this point in time, everything had been theoretical and armchair speculation about how societies operated and so on and so forth. The Chicago School was also a cradle of social construction. W.I. Thomas and his wife, Dorothy Swain Thomas, published a book in 1928 called The Child in America. And in this book, Thomas and Thomas said, if men define situations as real, they are real in their consequences. Now, this has always been my guiding dictum in the kind of social construction that I do. You'll notice that this is a very pragmatic kind of definition of social construction, and that makes great sense because the Chicago School at this point in time was heavily influenced by the philosophy of American pragmatism, as especially the work of John Dewey and George Herbert Mead, who were also on the faculty, not in the sociology department, but on the faculty at the University of Chicago. The second Chicago School, which is the one that I'm going to be mostly concerned with, dates from the late 1930s with the return of Everett C. Hughes. Everett had been a student at the University of Chicago, went off to teach at McGill, and then came back to the University of Chicago in 1938. And this period begins in 1938 and, in my mind, runs up through the early to mid-1960s. The key faculty here are people that you should now more of you should recognize. Elliot Friedson, who was a sociologist of medicine and medical work. Irving Goffman, who is noted everywhere and has done many, many things. It's hard to pin him down. Howard Becker. My favorite paper by Howard Becker is Becoming a Marijuana User. If you want to know anything about a career, this is the paper to start with. Boys in White was a book that was done by Hughes, Strauss, Becker, and Blanche Geer. And this was a study of how medical students learned to become doctors. And by that, they did not just mean learning medicine. They meant learning the role of a doctor, the norms of being a doctor, and so on and so forth. Melville Dalton was part of this group. I'm sure some of you have read Men Who Manage. Anselm Strauss, my actual favorite, right, is the same Strauss in Glaser and Strauss. he wrote a bunch of other things, too, that are actually very interesting. Don Roy, you've probably read Banana Time. My favorite one is a paper you probably never heard of called Sex in the Factory, in which he talks exactly about what you would think. Rue Buscher, William White, Bill White, Street Corner Society. I had the honor of actually being on the faculty with Bill for a while at Cornell University and the ILR School, and finally Julius Roth, who wrote a book called Timetables, which is about the career of a tubercular patient, and Ralph Turner, who is primarily known today, I think, as a theorist of roles. So those are the key faculty. Now, you may find that this slide misses someone that you might associate with the Chicago School, and that is Herbert Bloomer, who was the creator of what is now known as symbolic interactionism. In fact, he wrote a book called Symbolic Interactionism. Reason that I haven't put Bloomer up here is because he's not a sociologist of work. And the second reason is that Bloomer and Hughes, who was a sociologist of work, were on shall we say, different wavelengths. It's not to say that Bloomer had no impact on Hughes, Hughes's colleagues, and Hughes's students. But there was disagreement between Bloomer and Hughes based on what Hughes saw, and I see, as Bloomer's rejection of institutional structures and his belief that only thing that really mattered were subjective interpretations, and that was the proper matter for sociology. Howie Becker put this disagreement better than I could. Howie writes, Hughes and Bloomer had very low opinions of each other. Bloomer thought Hughes had a second-rate mind. And Hughes was openly contemptuous of Bloomer's inability and unwillingness to do research. Now, there are several key points to be made about these scholars and their work, aside from the fact that they were first and foremost sociologists of work and occupations. The first is that they did not ignore organizations. In fact, Hughes's dissertation was on the Chicago Real Estate Board. But they studied organizations as social settings and social structures where work was done. And that, in fact, was a perspective that was shared more widely than today in the 1950s and 60s, including members of the Tavistock Group, whom David will talk about soon, right? But with the rise of organizational theory in the late 1960s, the study of work atrophied in organization studies as the field turned to the environment. And the third thing to note is that from the perspective that their perspective, I guess is the way to put this, was an early form of institutional sociology. And they attended, because they attended to what we would now call the micro-macro link, their studies, their field studies, sought to link the world of everyday action to institutions. In fact, the book of essays that were written for Hughes's Festschrift was called Institutions in the Person. Like Giddens, the Chicago School sociologists held that institutions both shape and are shaped by human action and interaction. Their notion of this duality of social structure evinced itself in how they defined key concepts. So, for example, when they wrote about careers, and they did write a lot about careers, they argued that careers were a dual kind of concept consisting of an objective career, which are the positions you move through and how people outside of yourself think about what they mean, and the subjective career, which is what the individual perceives those sequences of structures and statuses to mean. They wrote about roles. Roles was a key concept, but they talked about role taking and role making. And what they meant by role taking was culturally defined duties and obligations that go along with the role. What they meant by role making is the idea that when we take a role, to some degree, we shape that role to ourselves in ways that make sense to us. There are various ways that the Chicago School sociologists championed participant observation. For me, this is perhaps their most important of all their contributions. In fact, Bill White entitled his autobiography, Participant Observer. Now, there are various ways that organization studies, I think, can benefit from reclaiming concepts and perspectives that were forged by the Chicago School sociologists of work. And one I want to talk briefly about is the idea of social worlds. So this is what Anselm Strauss had to say about social worlds. The point that I've highlighted in red, the stuff that I think is really important about this definition. And first is that social worlds are composed of groups who are involved in a common set of joint activities or concerns that are bound together by a network of communication. And so he goes on to enumerate social worlds. It could be the world of opera, the world of ballet, the world of baseball, the world of surfing, the world of art, the world of stamp collecting. And he goes on to say you could even think about this in terms of industries and the sciences and so on and so forth. And then he says one of the most important features of social worlds is their inevitable differentiation into subworlds. And he provides this very process-oriented image of what these subworlds do, right? They emerge. They evolve, they develop, they splinter, they disintegrate, right? So this was a very processual-oriented definition of social structure. But it was the joint involvement in the production of a core activity that made these all linked together. So social worlds, they say, can form around sites, technologies, and the division of labor. So I'll give you an example. Here's the social world of the theater. It has its own sites, the actual theater itself, prop workshops, dressing rooms, box offices, print shops, lobbies, stages, and so on and so forth. There's a group of technology that is associated with doing theater, lighting, sound systems, and you can read the rest. And there's a division of labor, different roles, actors, directors, stagehands, lighting engineers, patrons, advertisers, janitors, and so on and so forth. And as my lines here are meant to suggest, that some of these roles are tied to particular technologies and to particular sites, right? So in order to understand a social world, you want to be able to elaborate all this. You want to be able to see how the various technologies and the sites and the roles and the actions of people in those roles link together. And as important, right, you want to be able to see how these various groups not only collaborate with each other, fight with each other, right? Because it turns out that legitimation is a very important concept in the study of social worlds. And if I were to go on and take up more time, which I'm not going to do, I would go on to talk about how there were similarities between social worlds and what the neo-institutionalists today call organizational fields. But I'm going to skip that part of the talk. And instead, what I'm going to say is that in addition to these structural aspects, what were important for the Chicago School sociologists was understanding the way in which interpretive and political phenomena were integral to the organization and the conflict of social worlds. So ideologies, perspectives, theories, agendas, interests, and so on that differentiate participants who are bound into these networks and make their joint contributions to activity are still important. So we're going to be interested in interpretive differences that engender conflicts, that engender tensions, alliances, movements, disputes, and so on and so forth. So thus the interplay between networks and notions, that is central to the analysis of social worlds. And I want to end it by saying what I think, a quote from Anselm Strauss that sheds light on our activity here today, which is resurrecting prior perspectives. And Anselm writes, "Famous personages and also periods in their history may be reassessed, some being demoted, and others raised up or even rediscovered. Some are found worthless, stale. Others provide stimulating ideas and even technology which can be built on. Their ideas and work are more relevant, not merely more useful and suggestive, than that of many contemporaries. No matter that the ancestors might be turning uncomfortably in their graves, if they knew how their lives and works were being reinterpreted and selectively used." Thank you.
So, honestly, I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about when I was looking at what I was going to say here. And now that Steve has talked, I really don't know what I'm going to talk about. But I am going to, you know, refer to scholars of the Chicago School because it's been highly influential in the work of employment and careers. Or as I'm going to be talking about it, in careers and employment. I was asked to talk about employment and careers, but I switched the emphasis because it speaks better to what I care about and what I know about. So what I'm doing here is, when I say careers and employment, what I'm foregrounding is the individual rather than the organization and thinking about the individual as they move around in their career. My 15 minutes, I think, is also a little bit different than my fellow panelists, because rather than focusing on a particular school, I'm going to be talking about an area of research and sort of how the classics speak to it, in a sense, an application of some of the things that we'll be hearing about today. And when I thought about like using classics, I thought, do I actually use classics in my work? What does classic actually mean? So I sorted my EndNote database on date, and I looked at like, you know, do I have old things in there, right? And so it was difficult to really think about it, but I realized that I do actually use quite a bit of the classics, and part of the reason I do is the work that I do is around careers and job mobility. This is the area of research that I'm in, and a lot of the work on mobility of the style that I do it is really more modern. It really has exploded in the past 15 or 20 years, and so when I started doing this work, there wasn't much else to draw on besides the classics. So I'll start here. You might be asking, what exactly is a careers and employment perspective on the study of work? And you know, as I said at first, it's really about emphasizing the person and his, her, their interactions with the context of work and vice versa. So it really is about the relationships between people and organizations, how they come together and diverge over time. It also focuses on the career path over time and job moves over time. So there's a sense of process, there's a sense of movement when we're thinking about what is happening about work. So it's rather than focusing on what the person is doing, we're focusing on who the person is as they move through time and through various jobs. And it also foregrounds, you know, who the person is today, thinking about their past as well. This, how has their work today been impacted by what they've done in the past? The content of their work, you can, you know, shorthand that as human capital, the context of their work, the social context, having to do with relationships, with norms, institutions, and also cognitions around the work itself, mental models that you have, who you look to think about whether you're doing your work right, whether what you're doing constitutes good work. This sounded like an insight to me. You can't understand careers without understanding work, and you can't understand work without understanding careers, without understanding how individuals are traveling through the world and accruing all sorts of things, right? So I thought what I would do is I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about key careers and employment questions, and I'm going to be honest and say that these are the ones that are key to me, and think about what the classics have to say about it, or what I have, you know, I'm cherry-picking classics very much, and how they speak to some of these questions. So that's what I wanted to do. So the first one, I think that there's been a lot of work on how portable experience is. There's been some empirical studies that find that when people move from one position to another, their experience, their performance doesn't appear to come with them 100%. There seems to be some sort of thing that's lost at the boundary, right? And so how can we understand this? I mean, the one that everybody in this area of work draws on is Becker, not Howard Becker, but Gary Becker, and his ideas about human capital, his ideas about firm specificity or organization specificity, and why would organizations think about he was actually first interested in training. Why would organizations think about training people in a particular way, pay for training? And his theorization had to do with, well, there are some things that are really only useful to this particular firm, so the firm is going to pay for that, and these are firms that are specific or customized to, or skills that are specific or customized to this particular firm and not generally useful. So I think that that distinction has been a very useful way to think about the portability of experience. It's been extended to things like industry specificity or occupational specificity, and just this general idea of specificity and what it means to people moving around. But empirically today, we also know that firms pay for general skills. So I think that this is an interesting question that we haven't really addressed extremely well yet, and this is one of the ways that the classics can really help us understand, you know, or generate new questions. Another one that I just want to point out a little bit is Bourdieu. I think that his work on forms of capital has been very influential to me. It's been very interesting to me, this idea that forms of capital are fungible. That is interesting from a career's perspective. How does one form of capital convert into another form of capital? How do careers act as an engine to do this kind of conversion? How do class and habitus affect the career path, affect the career opportunities that are available? There's some interesting work going on in that area as well. A second question that I think is quite interesting is this idea of how do experienced workers make career transitions? And this is where I'm spending actually a lot of work right now. I'm writing a paper on this at this moment, and I'm thinking about what some of the earlier scholars had to say about this. I think that Schein's work on the individual, the organization, and the career, it speaks very clearly to this. He's really talking about what's going on inside of organizations and how people are socialized into organizations, how organizations are structured. But I think that the, you know, what he has to say really speaks clearly to what individuals are going through now, but it raises new questions as well, because as you're going from organization to organization, as you're no longer moving around within an organization, but across organizations, then exactly does socialization work? How should socialization work? So I think this is another way that you can, by contrasting, as Pedro was saying earlier, by contrasting what has been said before with some of the new issues that we are dealing with now, it can generate these new types of questions. It spurs you to think about what careers outside of organizations actually look like. He also theorizes not only movement, but he theorizes boundaries. And talking about boundaries within organizations, I think is really, the way he talks about it is very useful to thinking about what boundaries look like when you go across organizations as well. And so I think this work, even though it is about within the organization, it speaks very clearly to cross-organizational movement. As does the work of Lewis. And what she was doing, she was really typifying career transitions, but the way she did it, she really focused on sense making and how people moving into a new organization make sense of the new things that they're supposed to be able to do. They're understanding both objective and subjective of the differences between the old occupation and the new, or the new, old job and the new job. And I think that these, you know, what she's saying there is something that is really useful to be thinking about in terms of what organizations should be doing as they're incorporating people with histories, with career histories. And finally, this idea of what are the broader implications of career decisions. So Steve talked about this link between structure and action and the way the Chicago School thought about this link between structure and action. But Steve wrote a chapter in 1989 that has been enormously influential to people in the careers community, including myself, about what is the relationship between individuals and organizations mediated by their careers. Careers, as Steve has said, I'm going to keep on referring to you, but careers have a Janus-faced quality. They face up toward institutions, they face down toward individuals. And I think that that is a very, very interesting, it raises a very interesting set of questions, not only about how do institutions structure works, careers, and what people can actually do, but also how can individuals' career choices and career actions, how does that structure these larger social collectives, organizations or institutions? And so that has been a really, I think, fruitful area of work that needs actually a lot more work in that area. Yeah, okay. So one of the risks that comes with reading classics is when you read them, you feel like maybe everything has already been done, right? Like one of the things that you talk about when you're reading work on mobility or careers, you see a lot of things that say, now, these days, everything is different. People's careers are uncertain, you know, people are moving around a lot. This is, you know, all new. But it really isn't new, because Merrill Lewis in 1980 was saying, in the past 50 years, the norm of holding one job or remaining with one work organization for life has given way to a pattern of periodic job changing. And, you know, Walensky in 1961 was talking about the chaos in the labor markets. So it makes us feel like maybe this new unstable employment relationship that we all talk about now is maybe not so new. But on the other hand, organizations have unequivocally changed substantially in the past 40 or 70 years, so careers must have as well. And thinking through, you know, is this like just a matter of degree? Is it just moving faster, or is there something qualitatively different? Is it different? Is there a difference in kind that we're talking about? And it's useful to think through these things as we think through research opportunities and work and careers. So I'm just going to finish. I'm not going to take all my time. But I'm just going to finish with some, you know, as I was reviewing some of these classics, this talk actually gave me an opportunity to do that, so thank you. It was really quite easy to generate new ideas as you sort of juxtapose classics with modern context, with, you know, the way that you are thinking about your research today. And, you know, one of the questions is about, like, how should socialization actually work for experienced workers moving around? We have a very much a one-size-fits-all, integrating the newcomer into the organization, sort of ironing out the differences. But is that really the right way to do it? Is that the right way to think about socialization in organizations as you're hiring people with career backgrounds, with career histories? When you are moving around from organization to organization, what you've been through the socialization process, you know, a number of times, how does that affect you? How does that affect how you self-present? How does that affect how people understand who you are? And I think that this is, you know, an opportunity to use Goffman, you know, face in the Goffman sense, for example, and think about how we as a society can think about people who have been through many different career transitions, how people who have been through many career transitions can think about how they're presenting themselves. You know, things like habitus, how does that enable or constrain your career paths or your choices within an organization? And if careers and institutions are linked both ways, you know, how exactly does this process work of careers changing institutions? How do the actions of individuals affect what's going on in the institutional realm, in the organizational realm? And when we think about, like, sort of careers and organizations, careers and individuals, you know, what about occupations? How do these things cross-cut? So how does it all work together? Because when you're working in an organization, your job is partially your occupation, partially your firm, partially your industry. And so how does that all work together? Okay, so that's I'll finish there. Thank you very much, and thanks for the opportunity to look at some of this classic work again. I've enjoyed it.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.